Some big news in the meteorology world. Earlier this month, three scientists were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics, and two of them are meteorologists. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're going to talk with our weather guys about that, but we also are getting a check-in weather comment from Milwaukee area today. Tim Halbach is the warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. Sullivan, Tim, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
And, of course, Steve Ackerman, one of our weather guys, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, good to have you back.
Great to be here on this lovely day.
And John Martin as well, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. John, good to see your smiling face.
Same here, Larry. And Tim, glad to have you aboard.
So what's the weather been like near you lately? What weather questions do you have as we are in the fall season now? Join in 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Tim, what general area of the state do you cover in your meteorology work?
So our office covers 20 counties that run basically from the Dells over to Sheboygan, going down to the Illinois state line. So we're responsible for those. There's five offices that cover all of Wisconsin, La Crosse, Green Bay, Twin Cities, and Duluth. So my office does that, and we're also considered to be the state office. So we work with a lot of the folks over in Madison that have interests across the state, like the DNR, Wisconsin Emergency Management, National Guard, and those folks as well. So we cover all over the state, but our main focus is down in the southern part.
And how did you end up in meteorology?
So I grew up in Fond du Lac, and I witnessed the Oakville tornado from my driveway when I was a teenager. And my dad also worked for a farm service, so he was always watching the weather. And I remember going to watch him at work, and he actually had one of the like early computers that had radar on it. I thought that was so cool to be able to kind of keep an eye on that while you're working. So I think that kind of laid the groundwork for me.
Well, have there been any unusual weather events or patterns over in your area?
Well, the main thing this time of year, our office also forecasts out over Lake Michigan. So we cover the open waters, which is anything considered about 5 miles away from the shore, all the way out up in north and south across the lake. So this time of year, it's November gales time of year where we get these low pressure systems that come in, and anytime we get, you know, a storm like what we saw yesterday and today, we get some pretty high winds out across the lake. And it's normally kind of a busy time of year for the people trying to get stuff like barges up and down the lake before the winter hits in, where they start seeing a lot more ice and things like that, or the channels start freezing up. So that's the main thing right now. A little bit of lakeshore flooding in the Ozaukee, Milwaukee, Racine, and Kenosha County areas because of the wind that we've had the last 2 days. But that's pretty much the main thing we've been seeing around here. A lot of clouds and rain.
So when you get big winds, what are the size of the waves that you might see on the lake?
It depends on the fetch, so the direction of the wind and how long it's kind of aligned in that same direction. So for us, it's a north-northeast wind is probably about the worst that we can have. And if it lasts like that for a while, we can start seeing 10 to 50 feet waves. The stronger the winds get, if they're in that 50 to 60 mile per hour range, you might start seeing stuff close to 20 feet. So thankfully, the lake levels have come down about a foot or two since they were at record heights last year. So that might be a little bit of a help there. But still, if you're getting that big of waves, you can still see some erosion or flooding along the east side of Wisconsin.
Yeah. And how's the fall color looking in your area?
It seemed like this last weekend was pretty good. I don't know if because of the drought here in the southern part of the state, where a lot of the trees are either green and or, you know, just kind of dry. They kind of have this weird kind of look to it. But we drove around over the weekend, and a little bit of reds here and there, some bright yellows. But it seems like it's kind of been delayed because of how warm it's been, maybe a little bit of issues with that drought too.
Yeah, I there's what we're in the Madison area. John, what are we, 11 inches down, something like that?
Yeah, close, between 11 and 12. Yep.
And I expect over in the Milwaukee area it's about the same.
Yeah, and it gets a little bit worse as you get to Racine and Kenosha counties. They've been kind of the people that miss out on most of the rain over the past year or so. So they're kind of in a little bit higher deficit than that. So it's interesting how fast that kind of switched too, because the last 5 or 6 years have been all above normal for rainfall.
Yeah, it's really interesting. If you want rain, you should just get me over there to play some golf, because I was out playing golf. I was out playing golf yesterday at about hole 16 at the University Ridge Golf Course. We had a very uncomfortable last few 16, 17, and 18 holes.
Oh man,
it was bad. Well, what about? We've got Halloween Sunday. Any predictions on Milwaukee weather or your area weather for Halloween holiday and all those trick-or-treaters?
Yeah, so far it's looking good for much of Wisconsin, actually. It's looking a little bit more on the cooler side just compared to how it's been the last few weeks, but that's, I guess, expected this time of year. But the main chance for rain appears to be next few days, or in a few days, right around like Thursday or so. But at the moment, Saturday and Sunday are looking to be pretty good for much of the state. So that'll be good for the trick-or-treaters out there to get their candy.
I have a curmudgeon a friend who said, "I hope it rains hard." And I said, "No, you can't do that."
We had that a few years ago when I went out with my family and kids, and I think it was colder on Halloween than it was on Christmas. That I don't know if that was 2019 or what year that was. The last few years have been kind of a blur.
Oh, man. Well, anything else you want to share with us from your part of Wisconsin?
Well, just, you know, we're kind of getting ready for winter and looking forward to, some people might not be looking forward to it, but, you know, when we start seeing the next round of cold surges, it's starting to look like early November is going to be maybe when that transition starts to happen. So we'll be talking a little bit more, if you follow us at all on our website or social media. We'll be talking a little bit more about that transition to winter and some of the safety stuff and where you can get information from us in the next few weeks.
Well, you said social media stuff too. Do you guys social media folks as well, eh?
Yeah, we on Facebook and Twitter, we've got places that people can go off and vent about how inaccurate the forecasts are. And they let a little steam off, but we try to get our latest information out there for what we think is going to end up happening with if there's a winter storm, or Twitter, we're a little bit more active when the storm is actually happening. And same thing kind of goes for during the severe weather season as well, because information gets updates a little bit faster there. But otherwise, weather.gov is the main weather service website.
Yeah. Have you ever run into John Martin or Steve Ackerman here, our weather guys?
Yeah, John talked at a big winter seminar we had a few years ago in Madison, and got to absorb all the interest in winter weather from from him there.
Yeah, he's a winter weather guy, isn't he? You are, aren't you, John?
Yeah, I stand out as a real anomaly. I think Tim's with me, though. I like the winter. Maybe I'm a little more public about it than a professional forecaster would be, but I love it. So I'm looking forward to it. All those things you're talking about, Tim, it's like imagining a banquet. That's what it is for me. I'm really excited.
And that La Nina, isn't it? Aren't we supposed to have a La Nina this year? And is that going to create an issue for us weather-wise for winter?
Yeah, I think that's the way things are kind of shaping up at the moment. And that's pretty typical, I guess, to have back-to-back La Nina years. There's, you know, like every winter, and the professors here can kind of add on, but every winter is a little bit different. Some of the things that we've seen, at least, are a little bit more moisture and a little bit more, you know, in terms of, like, temperature swings, different weather patterns based on that La Nina and how it sets up. But every winter is a little bit different. If we get a couple good storm systems, that can kind of influence our pattern and what we get here.
Yeah. Well, pleasure talking with you. Oh, Karen in New Berlin had a question. I think maybe we can get that in quickly here, too.
Sure, go for it.
Yeah, Karen?
Hi. Yeah, thank you. I am wondering, we keep hearing about the drought out west 20-plus years, so obviously it's very dry. And what I'm wondering is when meteorologists, climatologists start to consider that to be more than normal as opposed to a drought.
Hmm. Steve, maybe turn to you.
Yeah, so I'll address the last part of when we start thinking of it as normal. And that is what normal is in terms of temperature and precipitation is a 30-year average. And every decade, that gets recalculated. And so we just did that for this new 30-year climate normal temperature and precipitation. So in that last 30 years, the dryness out west still classifies as a really strong dry period. But you're right. Eventually, as the climate changes, each time we do every decade a new calculation, that means that the temperature, normal temperature, is warmer than what it was 20 years ago, the way we're going with climate warming.
Yeah.
And then the drought, I guess, I mean, there was news over the weekend about all the flooding that is occurring because of all the rain that is now falling on regions of the West Coast.
So there you have it. We can talk some more about that. Tim, I want to thank you so much for taking a few minutes to be with us today. Really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
Yeah, you as well. Tim Halbach is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist for the National Weather Service office in Milwaukee, Sullivan area. John Martin with us and Steve Ackerman, our weather guys, and they're going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll be talking some more with them. Maybe we can talk a bit more about this whole business of climate change and drought conditions. And, of course, we'll take your questions as well, and I hope you join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us your weather questions and your weather photos. Love those as well, to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. News is next. We'll be right back. Talking weather and climate with our weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman, both professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And, of course, Steve Ackerman, also Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison, is probably taking up a little bit of his time these days, I'm pretty sure. Questions for our two guests. It was great to have Tim Halbach with us, by the way, and thanks again to Tim from the National Weather Service in our Milwaukee office, Milwaukee Sullivan offices, to join us as well. But if you have a question, I hope you'll join in, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@WPR.org. You know, when we were talking with Tim, this whole drought business came up, and it reminded me of the story. I picked up my copy of the Wisconsin State Journal this morning, and here's a column from you guys on rivers of the sky and how they help fight drought conditions. And I thought it was a pretty cool story. Steve, do you want to talk about rivers of the sky?
Yeah, so it's kind of an interesting phrase that I when they first started using it, I really didn't like it very much. Atmospheric rivers, they called it. But it's become a terminology that's accepted, and so I accept it as well. I think I didn't like it because I think they were first being really observed by satellites, so you could really see them all over the Pacific Ocean, and it would just be, you know, carrying lots of water vapor moisture that when it hits the West Coast, if there's a dynamical situation going on there, it can generate a large amount of precipitation.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And so that those rivers of the sky, when they hit, and I think there was a river of the sky in Northern California, wasn't there?
Yeah.
I lost you.
Yeah, John, we can hear you.
We can hear you, John.
Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't hear the last part of that question as all or comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're just still talking about rivers of the sky, and I mentioned that we had a little river of the sky hitting Northern California.
Yes, and an amazing event. I mean, the thing that for me, Steve was being really generous about this term atmospheric rivers. I had the exact same feeling he did when they were first introduced with that terminology in 1998. It's kind of a sexy terminology, gets you thinking about stuff, but really. As 20 years have passed, I've gotten less enamored with it because they're tied to organized weather systems almost in every case. And so I think what's a benefit is that it's forced people to think about these streams of extraordinary water vapor, not just horizontally but vertically enclosed as a stream of water vapor, in a way that they can actually start to measure one versus the other in the historical record. That's useful. But they're really just organized by extratropical cyclones and their interaction with the subtropics. A fascinating subject, but they're not a brand new thing. It's not like we discovered these atmospheric rivers and they never existed before. In fact, today Sacramento City had its all-time high record precipitation, 5.44 inches of rain, and it broke an all-time record that was set in April of 1880, which almost surely was a result of another situation quite like this one, although we don't have data that goes back that far. In the 3D atmosphere to be able to figure that out, but so that makes them interesting. And I think 30 or 40%, maybe even more than that, of California's the valley's precipitation is brought to it by these features. So they're very important,
and really problematic too when they come on the heels of a drought in the area, particularly with fires. So when you get that much precipitation and the ground is dry. Well, the vegetation's been burnt away. I mean, that just leads to flooding and mudslides and rockslides. And there's been some really impressive pictures in different news media about those mudslides and flooding that's going on there now.
Yeah, that's right. And as the weather system sags to the south, I think some of the larger counties in Southern California now, away from the central part of the state, are being warned about the exact same thing. So these things are predictable in the sense that when you've had a fire season like we just did, there's nothing to really keep the land from sliding when it gets hit with 3 to 5 inches of rain, and so they're really predictable, but not less disastrous.
Harold and Ripon, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Harold.
Hello. How are you doing, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I was wondering if the weather guy might help me with a conundrum. The lilacs are blooming in the fall, and I've never seen that, and I was wondering if there might be a weather pattern associated with that.
You know, we've had my garden talk show, that's come up a number of times, of people reporting that suddenly their lilacs are blooming again.
Wow. I mean, overall, Harold, I agree. This has been an unusual fall. Here we are on the 25th of October, and really it's the first fall feeling day to me, or one of them. Rain, 40-degree temperatures, and so on. We have an extraordinary amount of green leaves still on the trees at this time of year, and it's gotten beyond the point where just the most intensely observing person is noticing this. I think even the most casual observer is beginning to notice that we've got greenery here a few days before Halloween, which is very unusual. I don't know if it's unprecedented in my 28 or so years in the state, but it's darn close. So, we still got impatience growing in flower boxes when we're waiting for leaves to fall. This is that conjunction I don't think we've ever observed since we've lived here. So it's quite an unusual fall. I don't have a specific answer for your question, but boy, oh boy, it's part of a of a universe that this year that's quite unusual.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, we have been really warm, but yeah, I was noticing this weekend that I had this little rose bush, and it's got a beautiful flower on it and about six other buds.
And I'm like,
what?
Yeah,
what are you
doing? And I think,
yeah, right. What's the matter with you?
And you know, these plants are kind of have trained themselves to respond to the weather, and if you get like you get a little cold spell, which we had a little cooling spell, when was it, a month back or whatever, and then it suddenly gets warm, really warm, that's going to, I think, turn some of these lilacs and other plants into saying, oh, okay, I can have some more flowers now.
Yeah, maybe that's true. But, you know, I'll say this about this fall. Maybe you guys don't agree, all four of us maybe thinking about this. I don't think we've really had that sort of fabled Indian summer where it's gotten really warm at a late time of year. It's been a little bit warmer than normal. Yeah. So it hasn't really encouraged you to think, wow, you know, this is like a beach day sort of day in late September, early October. But it's been sustained above average. I think the monthly average is something like 9 degrees above average or something like that for Madison for October. So it's way above average, but never punctuated by something in the low 80s, you know, something really ridiculous. So I don't know. Maybe that does something different to the plants.
Yeah, I think the same thing with the minimum that we've been getting.
True.
It's pretty just steady. It's just not the
right.
3-day warm periods or anything.
Yeah, I don't know when the latest frost in Madison is or the latest, you know, 32 degrees for the overnight low is, but we must be getting close to the record.
November 3rd.
So we're really close. We're about a week away. And we haven't had it yet, and we may not have it this week.
Some regions have had frost, but I don't think it's been official yet.
A friend of mine said from northern Wisconsin posted on Facebook that they had their first hard frost.
Yeah,
occurred.
But that was undoubtedly quite late.
Right? Yeah. Yes. Indeed. Claire in Sauk County, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Larry. Hi, weather guys. I want to ask the experts about something that's been bugging me for a long time. Those gigantic water fountains out in Vegas. You know, here they are in the middle of this huge drought, and they've got these water fountains going. Where does the water, when it evaporates, where does it go? Does it disappear forever?
Oh, not forever. For less than 9 days. It disappears into invisible water vapor, and then it's kind of involved in something that condenses it back out into liquid or maybe even into ice and snow within about 9 days on average. So it doesn't disappear forever. It's a really good question. Water is recycled every 9 days in our atmosphere over and over and over for millennia. So it's a remarkably rapid cycle. But it is a great waste in that instance.
Yeah. My similar annoyance is in the hot summer days when you – walk by some stores and they got the door open and you can feel the air conditioning coming out.
Yeah.
Wait, what are you doing?
Yeah, right. What's the matter?
There you go, Claire. Every 9 days, did you say? 9 days.
Every 9 days. All the water. I just want to emphasize this point because it's hard to imagine. All the water that is currently in the vapor state in the entire Earth's atmosphere will be rained out or snowed out within 9 days. And it'll do it again 9 days after that. That is extraordinary. There's a huge amount of energy that's involved in that.
Claire, thanks. That was a great question. Tony in Egg Harbor, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call. I changed my mind. I was going to ask more about the weather event in California, but I think on a broader scale, global warming or climate change is also part of the same conversation. There was a news broadcast I picked up somewhere where some scientists have came up with the best reflective white paint, and they said that if we painted all our buildings and reflected back all the heat, the paint will actually cause the surface temperature to be cooler than the ambient temperature. And do the weather guys believe that we could really solve this problem just by having the best form of white paint?
I don't think it would totally solve the problem because it would change the amount of energy budgets, energy gains from the sun. And so reflecting that back out to space, if it kept the urban areas in particular, because that's where you would have most of your buildings, it might help alleviate that. But as long as you're still putting lots of carbon dioxide or methane into the atmosphere, that's still going to absorb the outgoing infrared radiation. So it might help, but I don't think it would solve it. And it would certainly make us live in a rather hospital-type looking environment.
Yeah.
A little clinical. And, yeah. I think I agree with Steve. The actual value of doing that would be very small compared to what's going on. You'd have to do the whole landscape on top of just buildings to make it white and have a huge amount of reflection. And then you can't do that to the oceans, which cover nearly 70% of, or more than 70% of the surface of the planet. So all of that surface would have to be increased in its reflective ability, and you couldn't do it. So you'd get a really small result for a big effort.
And thanks again for that question. Appreciate it very much. I want to go back because I made the comment earlier that there was some exciting news for meteorologists earlier this month when two were awarded Nobel Prize in physics. What was that? Tell us what that was about.
Yeah. When was that announced? About 2 weeks ago, I guess.
Yeah.
You said. Suki Manabe and Hausman, I forget his first name, Klaus Manabe.
Klaus, yeah.
Manabe was the first person to actually sit down and take the threat of increasing carbon dioxide fraction and put it into a numerical model that tried to account for it, and this was in the early 1960s, tried to account for all of the things we knew about the feedbacks and threw it into a complicated model that he devised himself at Princeton. And turns out he came out with a forecast of about a 2-degree temperature rise over the next 50 years, and he was just about right on. And this was the early stages of not only the technology for modeling, but also understanding the interactions between all the various processes that impact the climate system. So that's a huge advance. I met him a couple of years ago, and it was a great honor to meet him. And one of the things he said at the time was, maybe we're spending too much of our effort on little fine details of these new, much more sophisticated climate models, and we're not paying attention to the biggest part of the problem, which, of course, he has a bias because he solved the biggest part of the problem, but he might well be right. And then Hausman was the first to put weather and climate models together, and that gives us another advance in the way we think about the whole panoply of atmospheric processes and disturbances. So these guys were just giants in the field, and it's great they got that award.
That is very, very cool. You guys wrote about Arctic ice on your blog. Can you talk about Arctic ice and why it's important?
So Arctic ice is important for a couple of reasons. And, you know, sort of going back to what Tony was saying with regard to painting buildings really white and reflective. So one of the things the poles do is they reflect solar energy coming from the sun back out to the earth to prevent the warming. As the Earth has been warming up due to increased carbon dioxide amounts and methane amounts, as the polar regions warm, we've been seeing a continued decrease in the amount of Arctic ice. And so when that goes away, then instead of the solar energy coming down and hitting a bright white surface, it's hitting the water. And so it can go right into the water and begin to warm the water up because it gets absorbed by the ocean water there. And so we've been monitoring, and by we, I mean a number of satellite communities, global communities, the amount of sea ice since about 1978 or so. And what we've seen is a consistent trend in the decrease in the amount of that Arctic sea ice, which, again, is an indication the Earth is warming, but also that it's going to enhance the warming because more of that solar energy is going to be absorbed in the atmosphere. And if I remember right, the 15 fewest aerial coverage of sea ice, so the 15 fewest size of the sea ice, have all occurred in the last 15 years.
Mm. Yeah, amazing.
It's just amazing. I mean, that's just, you don't get records like that.
Right? No.
Helen, on another topic, Helen called, wondered if the clouds are white and the rain is clear, then why is it, then when we have a storm, the sky and clouds go so dark? What causes the change in appearance and color?
Well, that's a great question.
It is.
I often would put it to my classes, if water is clear, why are clouds white? And the answer is it's made up of droplets, and so the light scatters. And the best way to demonstrate that is to take a piece of clear glass and break it up into small pieces and pile it up. Well, that clear glass becomes white because energy is, you know, refracting and reflecting off those small particles. So when you look at the top of a cloud, as the energy's coming out, it's going to be white. But the bigger and thicker the cloud gets, less and less of that energy is getting out the bottom of the cloud. And so the clouds, storm clouds generally are very dark because that all that solar energy in the visible is being scattered and redirected either out of the top of the cloud or out of the sides of the cloud and not the bottom of the cloud.
It is kind of cool to fly through that. You know, you got a rain, you fly in the, take off in the rain, you fly through those black clouds, and then, oh, it's nice and white up here on top.
And then you got to close the window to see how it's so bright.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Oh, man. Bonnie in Milwaukee. Hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call today. Say, all the talk that you guys are doing reminded me of my days at UW-Madison back in the late 80s. I was in the wildlife ecology department doing a master's, and we were all talking about acid rain back then. We weren't talking about global warming or climate change yet. So whatever happened to acid rain? Was it ever a serious environmental threat, and is it still a thing? And I'll just hang up and let the weather guys handle that.
Yeah,
Thank you, Bonnie.
Good question. Yeah.
It's an excellent question, and it's true. It does reflect the fact that certain ideas take on a period of dominance in the thinking, and maybe mostly the reporting that goes from our field, because people were thinking about all those issues simultaneously. But, yeah, acid rain is a serious problem. I think it's done real damage to forests in the Northeast, if I'm not wrong. And I think that continues, although abated finally, because there have been some improvements in the way that, you know, particulate matter is allowed to leave smokestacks, and you know, we've put more regulations on that because it does real damage. And so these are the kind of policy decisions and implementations that are founded on solid science. And so there's been a lot of progress there. I don't know to what the extent of the problem still is. Steve maybe knows more than me.
Yeah, it is definitely improved, and I'm saying that because the EPA, particularly in the Northeast, you know, the EPA is monitoring the acidity of the precipitation as well as what's going on in the lakes. And they've seen that improvement because of the regulations of what can come out of smokestacks, if you will, that interact with the water vapor and get into the raindrops and turn them into more acidic. What I really remember being a New England guy who was growing up on Long Island was, man, some of the lakes in upstate New York were classified as dead. They become so acidic that the life that would naturally be in there couldn't survive anymore. And so there was a real need to clean that up. And I agree with you, John. It was a really big thing in the Northeast. Not so much because everything was going downwind.
And those lakes probably have cleaned up a bit since that.
Since the regulations by the EPA have certainly helped clear the problem up. It's a good example, I think, like the development of the ozone hole, right? Like, once we scientifically identify what is causing this problem, we can come up with solutions, make regulations, and head towards fixing it.
Right. That's right.
And Lisa may not have enough time to have her on, but she grew up in Vegas, and they built so many man-made lakes and fountains that they've changed the climate. So they now have humid rainy falls sometimes now in Las Vegas. I think part of it, too, is lawns, because a lot of people move from Wisconsin to Las Vegas, and then they've immediately started lawns.
Maybe golf courses, too, Larry.
Golf courses, too.
Yeah, that's right. Grass does not know how to manage water, and so if you keep pouring it on to keep it irrigated, it's just going to keep fluxing it back. So that changes the microclimate for sure.
That mysterious boom we heard in New Hampshire and parts of Massachusetts, there were lots of theories about it. Now meteorologists think it could have been an explosion of a meteor.
Man.
Yeah, and you know, it's a different kind of meteor than the kind of meteorologists do, but I think they were saying that because they could actually track it on a satellite imagery. So they could see it and know what it was, and that it wasn't an earthquake per se. It was a meteor or a bolide or something that actually exploded.
That's awesome.
Well, John, Steve, thank you so much. Look forward to your next visit. Thank you very much for being with us today.
You bet. We'll see you then.
John Martin, Steve Ackerman from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. Steve, of course, also Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education. Great to have them with us, and they will be back again. Tomorrow, Patricia McConnell joins us to talk about some research that asks what comes first, the anxious dog or the anxious owner. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.